Briggs.
Well, and speaking of anyone else from the public, I believe, other than from hearing from Mr. Nelson, we have all staff here except for Mr. Dan Berman, who is going to be leading the way with part of our tour later this afternoon. He's the director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. And I think everyone else is staff. So, shall we go into our discussion item then on...
Why don't we?
...for the day? I'm going to set the scene just a little bit. But first of all, before I launch into that, do any of the board members need a hard copy? Did everyone bring your hard copies with you? I see Bruce has his open there. Okay.
Yeah, I do.
So I'm going to spend a few minutes before turning it over to Michael, Lisa, and John. And we're also going to involve the board, of course, in this discussion, and we'll explain how that'll work in just a minute. I guess as far as introductions, I should say that Lori Okun was able to jet in from Points West to join us today. So Lori Okun's our counsel from State Water Resources Control Board.
Via Maui.
By way of Maui. So point sources and non-point sources. It's easier to get your arms around point sources and groundwater cleanups, and I think we've done a good job in handling point sources and groundwater cleanups. We need to keep working to make improvements in that area, and I think every time we have a discussion, for example, at the last board meeting, we talked about some improvements and potential improvements in how we monitor for some trace organics. So we need to keep trying to make improvements there. And with those areas, point sources, groundwater cleanups, the results are pretty measurable and tangible. In the last 10 years or so, more than 10 years, we've attempted to get a better handle on non-point sources, and we've tried to focus on tangible results. We've had our watershed management initiative. We've had TMDLs have just popped up in the last several years. We've had enhanced stormwater efforts, basically no stormwater efforts if you look back 10 years. And with those programs, we've also tried to focus on tangible results. Sometimes it's difficult to do that with the program requirements that we have. Concurrently, in that kind of that same era, the last 8 years or so, we've developed a regional monitoring program, our CCAMP, or Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. And I think it's the best regional monitoring program in the state. Not too hard to say that, since most regions don't have one at all, but that doesn't take away from the from those efforts. And Karen Worcester, oops, there's Karen, is going to update you a bit on our developments with CCAMP at the end of this session. So we'll hear from Karen a little bit later. The board itself has had a goal of tangible improvements in non-point sources during this last decade that I've been talking about, and I think the most cogent examples of those are with supplemental environmental projects, with settlements that the board has negotiated, with mitigation, some of the things that we were just talking about a minute ago, and then also in the last 2 years with Allison's work in the agricultural arena, the board is really focused on trying to come up with a program that's going to actually turn into results on the ground and water quality improvements. And even, was it the last meeting or meeting before, when we had the PISMO supplemental environmental projects, the board changed that with the city's approval to really focus on the implementation part of those monies as opposed to planning. You kind of switched it around and made the focus on the implementation instead of the planning. So I think the board has really focused on trying to make tangible results in the field. About a year ago, last June, at our offsite meeting, which was truly offsite, we discussed, Michael Thomas discussed riparian corridor conservation, and that went beyond discussion of sources but talking about the landscape and how do we protect the landscape, how do we restore the landscape for some critical areas, areas that are critical to water quality. Then last October at the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting, we heard some criticism of the regional boards for focusing too much on individual permits, not enough focus on water quality planning or broader issues. And Jeff and I talked on the way home from that meeting about trying to expand on the low-impact development discussion that we already had scheduled for the October meeting, which I think was about a week later, in Santa Barbara, and how can we raise our sights a little bit and look beyond what is certainly the work that the board has to do on a meeting by meeting basis in terms of the permits and the enforcement actions that we bring to you, but how can we at the same time have a broader vision? So then at the December board meeting, we had a range of topics. The end result of that was to try to focus on, again, low-impact development, innovative or enhanced stormwater management, riparian buffer zones, as we'd already talked about a year ago. So we've discussed a vision for the future of the Central Coast landscape, and we've been working on how to achieve it, but we need to have a clearer vision, and that means with measurable goals. Because if we don't have some concrete stepwise goals, it's difficult to tell if we're making progress. So we as staff have been working on just that, and our process and our progress are described in your materials for today. When the board directed us to bring this process back to you today, you wanted to have as many staff as possible attend to be able to discuss, and you can see we have a pretty good representation of staff here. And you also wanted, in terms of the written materials for the issues that the staff has brought up, you wanted to have those unfiltered. That is, you didn't want to just have what the supervisors thought were the ideas that should survive and be brought forward to the board. So you have just that with attachment one. You have issues that were brought up by staff, which led to the issue statements. So we're going to hear from Michael Thomas. That brings us up to date, basically, with where we are. We're going to hear from Michael Thomas with some remarks on our most recent attempts to define our vision. We will then hear from, if I've got this right, we're going to hear from Lisa, a little bit from John at that point, and then back to Lisa for our involvement with the board in terms of basically trying to do the same kind of brainstorming that we've done with staff with these bringing up these issues on the issue statements. And that we're figuring about 20 minutes for that. We will come back to both Lisa and John for the next steps, some further discussion from the board in terms of the overall picture that we have, and then to Karen for monitoring, and that will wrap that item. So on to Michael Thomas.
Thanks, Roger. As Roger mentioned, we started talking to the board about this, creating a vision and the vision process back in March. And talking about doing that is pretty easy. Creating a vision and measurable goals is quite a bit harder. And then actually implementing those measurable goals and finding ways to hold ourselves accountable is even harder still. But that's what we're in the process of doing. And since March, We started working with staff to develop a vision and measurable goals, and several staff members have stepped forward to take lead roles in that effort. And I just wanted to mention their names. John Robertson is going to be doing part of the presentation today. Jennifer Bidding, who's sitting next to Lori there. Jill Wilson, sitting next to Monica Hunter. Linda Stone is over here on the wall. And Dominic Rock is here next to me. Mark Angelo is in the back of the room there, and David Athey. Is he still there? There he is. So these folks stepped forward to take leadership roles in actually implementing this process of developing goals and a vision, and it's been a lot of work, a tremendous amount of work. And I also wanted to mention that we wouldn't be here today talking about this if it weren't for Lisa McCann and the work that she has done. And Lisa and I have had several conversations and debates, actually, about how to go about doing this. There are two basic ways we can go about it. we can dictate what those measurable goals are. You know, Roger or the board could dictate what those measurable goals are and what our vision is, and then order us all to go out and do it. The other way is that we could use a collaborative approach and involve as many staff as possible in that effort. And the second way, using the collaborative process, takes a tremendous amount of work, and it is sometimes messy, but we hope that in the end, according to other agencies that have done this, we hope that in the end we'll have a much better product and we'll have buy-in from the people who are actually going to do the work. And Lisa has helped us to develop that process, and I think that she grounds us in reality regarding that process. As far, at least for me, she brings me back to reality on a regular basis, and I really appreciate that. So with that, I want to hand it over to Lisa and John. Oh, I just wanted to mention, too, that their effort has been so far above and beyond the normal call of duty. It includes working on weekends and recently even on holidays to bring this information to the board and using this collaborative approach. So with that, I'll hand it over to Lisa.
Lisa, before you get going, it looks like maybe that flip chart is in the way of the screen for folks over here.
So, Michael, one of you was a proponent of the mandate process, and the other was a proponent of the collaborative process?
No. I think what happens is it's the way we think. You know, the way that I tend to think is that I want to define a problem and then solve it. Mm-hmm. I just want to go out and solve it. And what I'm saying that Lisa helps me do is realize that my definition of the problem and my solution might not be the best one, and that we can come up with the best solution and the best definition of the problem, the best solution, by involving as many people as possible who are actually going to be doing the work. So, like I said, she brings me back to that again and again.
Okay.
Quite an introduction. And probably pretty accurate, too. Thanks, Mike. All right. This was just an introductory slide to sort of stage or frame what we're doing here. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to introduce this slide. The purpose and the desired outcome of this effort that we are trying to do is we want to be an organization that achieves its goals by implementing its vision. A lot of organizations and a lot of companies come up with a vision. It's relatively easy to do. Few organizations are successful at actually implementing that vision and holding themselves accountable for doing it. We want to be an organization that actually implements its vision, and we want to be held accountable for doing that. And the desired outcome are tangible results over the long term. That's what we'll be measuring. That's what we are accountable for.
All right. So our discussions internally to date and the fact that we have launched this process have provided this really wonderful opportunity for staff to get together and share a lot about what they really care about and what they know a lot about. And it's also provided an opportunity for staff who don't normally work together to communicate more about their various roles in our organization. And we're really looking forward to the opportunity to open that discussion up more, include board members, and ultimately other members of the public. The way we've set this process up, this is a really important distinction here in terms of roles of everybody involved, staff and the board. It's not business as usual. We're going to look at this as if we're all stakeholders. We all have information about what's going on in our region, and we all have interests in what we're doing and where we're headed. So we might have to remind ourselves periodically, or we might remind you along the way that is your individual roles, is to participate as stakeholders in this process. And we're not necessarily bringing you a recommendation for you to decide on. Today's meeting is just about discussion anyway, and you're not taking any action, and that's the nature of our interactions. So this is just a snapshot of what we've been up to, and we hope when we're done with our presentation and discussion today that you'll have a much better window into what we really mean, because we're going to let you actually experience some of it along with us. You can just Sorry. We have an old version of the presentation, and we really want to use our revised and improved version. So I'm going to keep talking. John's going to switch us out here. All right. What do you need? You can have that. Here. I'll help you. Okay. So we have been looking at strategic planning processes and re-educating ourselves. Some of us are educating ourselves for the first time. And we recognize that it's not a simple task for an organization that's as complex as ours, that has so many different functions, multiple authorities, and has to deal with quite complex range of issues. It's exciting. It's an exciting step we're taking. It's also challenging and, to some extent, risky because we're not that experienced at this as staff. It's not what we normally do. Some of us have participated in these kinds of processes and have been involved in designing them on occasion and along the way in our careers, but most of us haven't done this on a regular basis. And as Mike pointed out, many of us are doing this as an add-on project to our existing work, and that's true for pretty much everybody. I mean, when we ask staff to come sit in a room and give input, that still requires them to put their work aside and you know, turn on their brains and leave their other work aside and be thinking about inputting to this. So that does create a challenge, but we are rising to it. We're drawing on lessons and advice from a variety of experts and methodology that's out there, and we're involving a lot of different staff, some of whom are perhaps a little more like me in terms of being process and planning junkies, but in general are definitely dedicated and creative and wanting to really contribute. All right. We'll forget it then. Forget it then. Yeah, you just use the old one. Sorry. I don't know what happened. There. Yeah. Thanks. All right. Well, to the point of this little technical glitch, this is already looking and feeling a lot like a presentation, and we really wanted it to be a conversation anyway, so we're just not going to worry too much about the slides. We're just going to keep going, telling you what we want you to know and hearing from you. So this, four, okay, that, when it gets there, is going to be a schematic of the process, the way we've configured it to date. And we are adapting from a methodology called Managing for Results. It's new to us, but Michael actually went to a course and got some information and learned from Wiedner, who's the consultant and expert and who's implemented this process for many organizations. And one of the key things that he emphasized is the importance of choosing a methodology regardless of which one you choose and then relying on that and sticking to that methodology all the way through. So we are adapting our process from his methodology. We are at the very beginning. In managing for results, there's basically three phases. And we are in about halfway through the very first phase, which we're calling creating the vision. And that means we're like 2 to 3 months out in what might be a year to 2 year process. So we've really just taken baby steps here in the big picture grand scheme of what we're doing. And what I mean by that is we're talking about moving forward from creating an actual vision statement and actual measurable goals to then reviewing what we do every day and how we do business and how we might want to make changes to implement the vision, and then ultimately to do the implementation, to try those recommended changes and measure our success at doing that. It's your turn. Yes. Just another. Yeah. Can you go back one? They never saw it, right? Yeah, they never saw it.
As I remember, before I left the board at an off-site meeting, didn't we have something about PowerPoint presentations on ranking them?
Yeah.
Do we still do that?
We haven't.
Okay.
Take notes, John. Give them to us afterwards. Okay, I just wanted you to see what the picture looks like, because it might have been floating around there behind me while I was talking, but just to give you. So those are the three phases: create the vision, align the organization, implement and measure, and hopefully be able to demonstrate tangible results. And there we are, as I said, about halfway through the very first phase, a couple months out. Okay? Mike alluded to, and I made some comments about the complexity and the challenge. John's actually going to talk to you about meeting that challenge.
Lisa, does this track what's in Attachment 1 in our staff report or Attachment?
No, right now I'm just describing generally what's in words in the staff report. We'll get to referring to Attachment 1, and it'll be very explicit.
Okay.
Lisa also mentioned or alluded to the fact that traditionally the offsite board meeting has been an informal kind of setting. John said something about grading the PowerPoints. Actually, we kind of had an unwritten rule, or we're trying to reduce the amount of PowerPoint used in those and create more of a dialogue between parties. And to that end, I would encourage questions come up, or if comments come up, to go ahead and interject them in the process. With this slide, I titled this slide Meeting the Challenges, and I was trying to get a double meaning out of that. One is meeting as in the sense of introducing ourselves to the challenge. The other is meeting as in the sense of overcoming our challenges with regards to implementing our vision. There are over 5,000 publicly traded companies in America. Most, if not all, have been through a vision or mission process at some point. Many of us in this room have participated in those. I know I have, at least once. Okay, now I'm going to throw some numbers at you, some more numbers, lots of them. There are 58 counties in California, and there are over 400 cities in California. There are at least 50 state agencies at the Sacramento level. Now consider there's also 49 other states and the federal government and all the agencies that are included with the federal government. So I think it's a safe assumption that at least as many public entities have attempted the vision, mission process as there are private companies that have. And most of us in this room have participated in at least one of those. To borrow from Elvis, that's a whole lot of visions going on. But not all of the visions are hitting the target. Actually, the consensus number is about 30% of the visions that are developed are actually implemented through to conclusion. So what we need to do is find the common threads of success in those companies and those public agencies that did make it through to full vision implementation. In a sense, how do we pull the rabbit out of the hat? Not to suggest that there's any magic involved in this. It's just hard work. There's no avoiding the fact that in analyzing organizations that are successful in implementing their vision, the largest single factor is leadership. Analyses of successful organizations yield this unambiguous point. But I say this is not just from a list of usual suspects. Success will not be built by the list of usual suspects in leadership. What I mean is that success is built through the leadership of more than just one person. Roger and Michael working together will not achieve vision implementation, nor will Lisa and myself. Some of the measurable goals we'll talk about later actually have endpoints that once we achieve them, will Roger, Michael, Lisa, and myself will have actually retired before that time frame comes to fruition or comes to completion. Obviously, we're going to measure ourselves and our progress along the way, but and we'll readjust as need be. But some of the problems we're confronted by in water quality actually have that long a timeline. I also say right people in the right seats. What I mean is aligning the talents and skills of individuals in the office and using their leadership skills to achieve the steps towards the desired outcome. I'm going to use an example here, and I warned you, Allison, that I was going to use this example, and you didn't leave the room. I think the example actually vividly illustrates both of these points that I have up here, and it does so with great outcome. Allison piloted our agriculture regulation effort that, through a consensus approach, yielded our ag waiver, which was adopted in July of last year. This is a monumental first step in getting our hands around ag-related discharges. And it's also a great example of both getting the right person with the right talents in the right seat and leadership from someone who was not on the list of usual suspects. Lisa said she is now. This slide actually had a different title last night and caught a lot of flack for it. It was a geologic term. So as I was sitting back trying to think, okay, what do I want to call this? I thought sports metaphor. Need a good sports metaphor. And it got later, and I thought about dinner. And there you go. Successful organizations must commit their whole organization toward achieving the vision, the whole enchilada, everything. No holdouts, no holdout units, no holdout personnel. All portions of the office must be involved and committed toward realizing the vision, and they must work together. I'm going to skip the example. I think this one's relatively self-explanatory. If not, raise your hand. Simply said, change frightens people sometimes. Whether it's a perception or a real hindrance, the obstacle must be considered. As a statewide agency, we develop patterns or methods of how we do our business, often because it's how we've always done our business. That's not passing judgment to say that we should throw everything out, but too often we accept these patterns as unchangeable norms rather than the acts of convenience or habit they actually are. Lastly, I'll bring up the issue of institutional discipline. This is a key element of success for most organizations, and probably the one that they trip up on most frequently. Institutional discipline refers to follow through. We must not be content to build a vision and then not go get it. This is likely the single biggest challenge to achieving the vision and the place where most attempts fail. Generally, our collective attention span is not long enough to stay focused on the distant horizon that is our vision. Too often, we have a channel surfing mentality that allows our heading to slip to whatever the latest administration or legislative fire drill demands while coming off that distant target that is our vision. I'll go back to the reference that I made on the first slide of this sequence. Of the thousands of unachieved visions that I made reference to, I suspect the majority of those that fail do so because of a failure of disciplined follow-through. Now, this is in summary, in teaching ourselves what allows some entities to succeed and some and while others fail. We've learned that there are some common threads necessary for success. This knowledge will help us along our way and enhance our opportunities to succeed as we journey through this process. I'll get back to you.
together. All right. So with that stage set, this is just to reorient you, that remind you that here we are at the beginning of a process that we're about to launch deeper into. And I want to zoom in and talk to you more about what we've done in this phase one and what we're up to there in creating the vision. Can you see that okay? Can read it? All right. It's yellow on my version. What is a vision? So again, we're using the terminology and approaching vision from as defined in this process, Managing for Results, which is a picture of the future if we achieve all our goals. That's what we want our vision statement to say. Vision is intended to communicate a sense of purpose, has to say what's important and why, and it should focus on the future. Oh, we got this old example, actually. I'm going to read you this vision statement that I have here because we like it better, and it's more illustrative, and it's more relevant to an organization more like ours. So this one says, the Department of Environmental Protection provides protection and enhancement of water and air to support multiple uses. So states its purpose, says what the organization is up to and why. We thought it would be nice to actually consider some pictures of the future of our region, so we've just put together a few choice slides for you. This is actually one of the restoration sites that you're going to see later today, and that's what it looked like not too long before it got looking the way you just looked at it. Nice. I'm just going to leave that there. I think I'm just going to leave it on that slide and talk through our next bit of information here. Again, just to remind you, we're talking about phase one, creating the vision. What we've done to date is held 3 workshops with staff. And in the first one, we conducted a general brainstorming session. And we asked staff to just throw out statements in response to what's their desired future condition for our region. And we recorded all of them. Kind of messy. Well, let's see. Can you just so I can see the slides? I'm gonna go to. Okay, this is a subset, just to give you an example of, this is not exactly what you have in Attachment 1 yet, but this is just an example of some of the statements that we recorded at the first general brainstorming session. So then we went on to a second workshop, and at that one we sort of reframed the same approach. We were still looking for just general brainstorming on important issues in the region, but we directed staff to think about issue statements, again, adapting from and as defined in this process managing for results, in which case you're supposed to think about facts that articulate a trend and an impact. Okay, so here we have an example of an issue statement that at least meets that definition or the test. So you can see here we have the trend is urban development in the next 20 years due to population increase, and then the impact, pollution, degradation of water quality, etc. An important point about issue statements in this particular process is while we're spending a lot of time developing the issue statements themselves are not what ultimately matters. It's a step in the process to inform the vision and the vision statement and the measurable goals. So while we're doing some wordsmithing and making sure that the words cover the important issues, ultimately the issue statements themselves will not be what we attached to or share around or necessarily would be on our website. Again, this is just a way to organize our thoughts and focus on what's important and get agreement on what's important so that we can go forward through the process. Okay, now I want to call your attention to your attachment one to illustrate better to you how we got from the brainstorming session and lots of statements, issue statements. What's happening to this mic? To an actual set of simple set, or five is the number it came out to be, of general issue statements. So in your attachment one, if you look at sentence number three, or statement number three. What I have up on the screen is the bullets represent a subset of the numerous statements that are listed on your attachment one under statement number three, and just statement number three. Actually, I'm sorry, it's not statement number three. What we have on the bottom is a draft issue statement, which should be slightly different than what you have. And so what happened is after we did this brainstorming of the issue statements, a small group of staff, the steering committee members that Mike mentioned, got together and grouped, reviewed and grouped the statements that were similar and overlapping and tried to come up with patterns and draft statements that we felt umbrellaed or were broad enough to encompass and simplify all those numerous statements that are recorded there that people offered during the session. And that led us to a group of five draft issue statements. Okay. So at our third workshop, we attempted, or the purpose of that session was to gain consensus on the five issue statements. And in order to do that, we looked at the draft issue statements. And we facilitated the discussion by asking people if they could live with the statements as they were represented, the draft issue statements. And there were some people that didn't agree with some of the language. And then we had, as a group, we discussed what those issues were and developed some edits and considered some edits to those sentences until we could get everybody to say that they agreed. So what I am trying to demonstrate specifically here is you can see that in the second statement that, for example, people felt that the general statements about agriculture, urbanization, and grazing was too general, that it implied that in all cases those are always impacting activities, and preferred for it to be qualified to suggest that only when improperly managed. for water quality, would those have an impact on water quality? So we added that phrase to the beginning of the sentence in the bottom. Another example of a change was that people said, well, grazing is really a subset of agriculture. We don't need to call that out individually. So we just lost the term there and agreed that agriculture meant grazing as well as irrigated ag and orchards, et cetera. And let's see. Oh, and then the last change we made to this particular statement. I'm using this statement because it's the one that we worked over the most and had the most significant changes. So I think it's very illustrative for you. So the last change was that we had a discussion about does urbanization, for some people, urbanization implied development, future development, new development, and didn't necessarily account for existing industrial, residential, commercial, or even future industrial, residential, commercial activities that end up causing pollution in terms of like spills, tank spills, discharges to groundwater, just, you know, business that happens by the way we live. So we wanted to clarify that. So we changed, we qualified or modified urbanization to add that those words and supporting infrastructure to account for that issue. Okay, now it's your turn. So, what I want to do, I'm going to try to talk loudly. Can tell me if my voice gets too low and I'll...
Why don't you use the...
You think I should use that? Well, I can use that. Well, I'd rather use this so I can actually use my handheld. Yeah. Mute no longer. Okay. So what I want to do is pass out, if I can find them. Did you do that already? Ooh, I have them. Okay, John will pass out. This is just a simple, clean copy of the five issue statements. They are the same as the bold statements in your attachment one. And there's enough from others beyond the board members who are here, but I want to make sure that the board members get copies first. And while those are going around, I'm just going to explain what I want to try to do right now. We want to give you an opportunity to act like the stakeholders that you are and actually try to repeat the same kind of facilitated discussion that we had with staff in trying to gain consensus on these five statements. So we're going to ask you to tell us whether you can live with these statements as written. For this to work, you have to be willing to play along by the rules, follow the same process, and follow the same ground rules that we used. And I'll tell you what those are in a minute. I'll give you a little time to think about the statements after giving you all the instructions, and then I'm going to ask you to actually tell us whether or not you can live with them or not. And if any of you say that you cannot, then I will ask and invite everybody who has worked on these and already discussed these once in a group together to discuss with you and try to illuminate what your concerns are if you have them, and either try to convince you that your concerns are in fact covered by the statements that you see on the paper, or if not, are there some minor edits that we can make to satisfy the issues and get you to say that you can live with them. All right? And what we're also going to do here is Dominic is going to record all of your comments so that no matter what happens and what the statements look like and whether we have agreement at the end of the session, we will have recorded what your issues are and what you have to say about them so that we can look at that later. And Jill is going to help out in this little speaker lineup in the event that one of you board members says, I have a question or I can't live with them, when the entire room stands up and wants to respond, we'll put people in order to speak and keep track of that so that we can recognize everybody that wants to participate in the discussion and has something to say. Okay. So levels of consensus, is that the next one? Yeah. Okay. So for consensus, we need a definition of consensus. And the way we approached it was by these definitions, levels of consensus. So we have consensus if everybody says that they are at 1 to 4. So 1 being, I like them. They're fine. They're great. I have no problem. 2, they're okay. You might not love them, but you're willing to say they're okay. 3, you'll just live with them. You'll just stay quiet. You'll live with them. 4, you don't like them at all, but you don't think they're that off, or you're fine, and you won't block if we want to go forward with them as is. And any one of those 4, if you feel any one of those 4 statements about these issue statements, we would say we have consensus. If any one of you, on the other hand, says, I'm a 5, I hate these, I don't like them, I will block them, not going on until we take care of these, then we don't have consensus, and then that would open up the floor for discussion about that. All right? Okay. Okay. So let's see. Okay, so what I want to do is have you take 5 minutes. If you're all done in less than 5, we'll stop and just, we'll all be quiet. You read the issue statements, and I actually encourage you to write down if you have any issues about them or and whether or not you think you can live with them. So the question we're asking you to answer is, can you live with these as is? Before you start, I just want to remind you of a couple things. That the issue statements are intended, at this level in the process, they are intended to be broad, but they should cover important issues for our region. They, again, are a step towards informing what our measurable goals will be and what our vision statement will say. The words themselves will not continue to exist as a significant part of the process, but they do need to acknowledge and cover important issues and have everybody feel that they do.
Lisa, I'm curious why number 1 is there.
Issue number one.
Is there? I mean, it doesn't. Is it? It's not asking for a next step unless it's an acknowledgement that the process that has been used in the past is the model to be used to address 2, 3, 4, and
okay.
5.
It is unique. Validating your observation, Jeff. I would like to not answer your question, though, until I get done with the instructions, and you can raise your hand first and ask that question when we get to that part, if that's
right.
Okay with you. Thank you. What's that? Yeah. Jeff's first. Thank you. Let's see, what else? Okay, I mentioned the statements, and again, a reminder that the goal here is to get consensus, to get all of you to say that you can live with them. Okay? Okay, so your time. Take your notes and questions on the issue statement. Let's see, John, who's here? Monica, Jeff, Russ. That's it.
Bruce,
huh?
Is on a phone call.
Yeah.
So he should be back in here.
Yes.
You possibly want to point out that the goal is not necessarily for everybody to be at 4. I mean, that would certainly define your definition of consensus, but the bar would be mighty low if everybody was just, well, I don't like them, but I'm not going to block them.
Okay. For today,
so the goal would be
yes.
Actually at the top
yes.
of the list rather than the bottom.
Right.
Of the list,
but did you hear what Sorrel said? She said, wouldn't the goal be to have more people beyond, above a 4? Wouldn't it be great if everybody could be a 1? The answer is yes. But for this process and for today, and because what we're really doing here is just in part trying to demonstrate to you what we've been doing with our time in these sessions, is that the rules for today are just simply, are you 1 to 4? Or are you at a 5? We're not going to spend time, because we could spend all day perhaps wordsmithing and working on the statements, if the goal is to get everybody to a 1. Okay? Oh, I have. I know. Let's see, just writing. I'm going to go get a drink of water. Kidding. Not running. Yeah, this is fine. Oh, Jeff left. As soon as Jeff comes back, we'll get going. Unless someone wants to get in line ahead of him. We'll just bump him and
we'll put your name on
the Oh yeah.
Let's go out of order.
Okay, but just go get Jeff. This really doesn't work if people aren't in the room. Okay. All right. All right. Jeff's back. Okay. So the question on the table is, this is the question for Les, Russ, Jeff Young, Monica, and John. Can you live with the statements as written? Or are you a 5?
Okay, we're not.
Are you a 5?
Starting from the bottom up. I started with number 4. How about a number 4?
John, turn on your microphone and pull it.
I'm at a number 4 on on the whole page. Then as you go up, I become a number three. Because, you know, some points are, some statements stand out more than others. I'm definitely between a two and a three on the whole page, closer to a two. Is that what you wanted?
That was great. All right, let's go back. Thank you for demonstrating just what we want to do here. Jeff, we put you first because you started out with a question early on. So,
well, other than my question about why is number one there, I'm fine with all of them.
Okay.
Some of these are kind of interesting that they even show up because it just demonstrates that there's a lot more going on in the organization than, you know, the board is aware of. Like number two. So, you know, I've got no perspective on that. I'm really curious what that's all about and how you even approach getting that corrected or improved. But I like four. And I like three and I like five.
All right.
So, I mean, four to me kind of gets at my sense of what our goal and vision is, which is, you know, protection of beneficial uses, restoration of beneficial uses. All those concerns that I have, I think, can be dealt with in implementing and carrying out number four.
Okay. So, great. Monica.
Thank you. I would be at a number one, except for one issue that I don't see reflected in two through five, and that is related to the need for education and outreach. It's only in the specific statements. It's only mentioned twice in number three, but if you consider the need to update and retrain the professions, it really is underlying many of the other issues. For example, those that are involved in many different facets of maintaining, modifying, and redesigning infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So if there were a way to incorporate and target the need for education and outreach in possibly, say, number four, where infrastructure is specifically mentioned. But there are other ways to identify education outreach. And this is to stress, this is just not about the general public. It's about everybody that is engaged in managing not just our resources, but our civic institutions that make planning decisions that just aren't, they're very busy and it's challenging enough just to keep things going forward, let alone try to take account of new directions that are going to fundamentally change the way we build and create our neighborhoods and utilize our very limited resources.
Okay.
So I guess I'm a two.
I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Russ or Les? You. Better than fives?
I just more or less scored them. I like number one. I mean, I like that quite a bit. On two, I gave that a two because I'm not sure that I'm equipped to evaluate how things work in-house. You know, that's a question of organizational structure and efficiency. Departmentalization.
Is that mic on?
Oh, and I can't see the green light.
We were just having a nice conversation.
Yes, a dialogue.
Whoops.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Okay, so two. I'm not really equipped to evaluate that one. So I think that needs to. I agree on three that there is a need to measure tangible results, and there is a problem. But I think, given financial constraints, we need to spend an effort in sampling smarter, monitoring smarter, and that goes into sampling design and those kinds of things where you can get more information with the same amount of expenditure of time, energy, and dollars. I have a question on bore, and that is the words critical habitat loss, critical for whom, in what way. That's kind of a, it's not defined, it's a squishy word. Parking lots are critical habitats for cars. You know, I mean, what do you mean by critical habitat exactly? Critical, and I think the emphasis here is critical in terms of water quality, which may not necessarily be critical for other things. Mm-hmm. So
can would you say you can't agree with it because of the vagueness of the word critical, the way you just articulated it, or could you say you were 3 or 4? Even though you articulated an important point about the word.
Well, the critical habitat loss, the sentence, the phrase, the concept is great without the words critical habitat loss. I mean, I really have trouble with the critical part because I'm not sure we know what we're talking about exactly.
Okay.
Other than that, it's fine. And 5, I agree with wholeheartedly. Is that?
Okay.
That was a quick study, wasn't it?
Okay. Russ?
I scored the first two as a 2 because I think I need more information. What are you really saying? 3, I gave you between a 1 and a 2. I like it, but then you're okay. I think I need to expand a little bit more. It's pretty hard with just one sentence or two sentences to understand what you're trying to say here. 4 and 5, I agree with you 100%. I like them. I think it's, for me, it's on target what we're doing, the issues. And I don't look at habitat loss as cars on a parking lot. We lose a parking lot. That's not a loss to me. I think that's a gain because I look at more area for water percolation. But urban people, as I am, may think, or a developer may think, the loss of a parking lot is a loss of habitat for them. So it all depends on what eyes you're looking through.
Okay, a couple things. Unless you're stuck saying you absolutely cannot agree, you have to be a 5. I actually believe we have consensus. Because you all said that you're at least a 1 to 4 on all 5 statements. Mm-hmm. Are you with us on that?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Good job. Okay. Your observations are great. The words are sometimes hard to define. You weren't in the room when we had some of these discussions and we brainstormed these issues. But for yourselves, remember you can look back at Attachment 1 and see at least a little bit more of a window into the different ways that staff articulated the issues that we then rolled up into these words. And that, at least on face value, will be a little more illuminating. With the exception of, and I also should point out that the piece of paper I distributed to you has the order wrong. Number 1 is actually number 5 compared to Attachment 1. So to Jeff's point, why is that there? It's a little bit that isn't directly related to the specific statements that were made. That was an attempt to address some issues that kind of, comments and general discussions that we had after the brainstorming issues. So it may or may not need to, the issue statements are, again, remember, not necessarily going to move forward as they appear on the piece of paper today. So when we develop measurable goals and try to create our vision statement, we'll need to reevaluate what that statement is currently doing there as an issue statement and whether it morphs into a goal of some sort or part of the vision statement. All right? Thank you for your participation and your comments.
Well, how does staff rank these?
We didn't rank. We did exactly what you just did.
We just discussed whether, as a group, anybody in the room could, everybody in the room, whether they could just all say that they have enough levels of agreement or that we should move forward with the process.
Did you get consensus?
We did.
But it took some wordsmithing to...
Oh, wordsmithing.
Yeah, to get consensus.
Yeah. I tried to illustrate that with the slide where I was talking about
the draft issue to the final issue
statement. And we scheduled to work on it for about 20 minutes. It took closer to 60. And part of that demonstrates that, you know, we're a little inexperienced. I don't do this kind of facilitation every day. But the flip side of it is it was successful and that we had really robust discussion. People came up with words and understood each other's issues, and for the people that didn't agree, and most of the comments we got after that workshop is that it was pretty successful. And that's how it goes. Yes? Okay. Just about to tell you that. I think we should skip the mission discussion. Yep. We don't have time. We have 5 minutes to wrap. I think we should just tell them later. Excuse me, 1 second. I don't think we should skip the measurable goals discussion. Just go to the conclusion. Because we'll say we're going to develop measurable goals.
But measurable goals is what's next.
You will say it's what's next, but we won't explain it right now. Because we will be at 15 minutes if we do that. What do you want to do?
Can you do it in 10 minutes? Can you do it in 10 minutes?
I don't know if you can do it.
He said he
could
do it.
Okay. He's with you. All right. Just trying to cut it short so we don't run out of time, but... We're gonna go ahead. You have your. We did do that. Okay. Oh, I got this on. I got this on. I can just talk. Okay. So this is a schematic close up of phase one, not the big picture, just phase one, creating the vision. 3 workshops. We got down to workshop 3. We finalized the issue statements. We road tested them with your input. And we actually started at our 3rd workshop working on measurable goals, trying to educate ourselves about how we approach that, what that means. So what we want to do now is just talk to you a little bit about how we're defining measurable goals and approaching development of measurable goals. But in fact, we didn't get that far on it. So specifically to answer your question, Monica, our most concrete next step is starting to work on measurable goals. And I'll come back and say something about that and put that in perspective for you after John gives you a little tutorial on measurable goals.
How's that? Yeah. Much better. Thank you for the segue, Monica, by the way. Okay, now we transition from issue statements into measurable goals. And what you need to understand is, and I think Jeff brought up, why is one issue statement in this? As we go to measurable goals, the issue statements will cease to exist, and all we will have left are the measurable goals. So if it is such that we cannot develop a measurable goal for one, then it will cease to exist. So they kind of self-cleaning in a sense. We took longer than we wanted in workshop 3 focusing on the issue statements and reaching consensus, but it is what it is. The process is what it is. It's more important to get it right. So we had less time to focus on measurable goals. We broke into small groups and attempted to develop measurable goals on the 5 issue statements. And first, let me go through what is a measurable goal. Thank you. Okay. Measurable goal is defined by an outcome, a desired outcome that you want to achieve, and then a time frame in which to achieve that goal. Typically, measurable goals are long range, 5 to 25 years. I would say it's analogous to looking at the distant horizon, maybe the ridgeline, a faraway outcome. Not to be confused with shorter-term goals that we'll come to in a later phase of the process, which are more interim steps along the way, that we would measure our progress towards our measurable goals. I want to define measurable goals for this process. A measurable goal is basically it's a means to a quantifiable means to measure our progress towards our vision. Go ahead. And measurable goals can be either direct or indirect measures of water quality. I want to emphasize that. Now let's revisit our example that Lisa has taken us through to this point. Go ahead, Clay. This is, I believe, issue statement 4. Is that right? On your handout? Okay. This is a multi-headed monster. This is going to generate several measurable goals, obviously, because it's amalgamated a bunch of different issues. For the purposes of this discussion, let's just focus on agriculture. Okay, what I've done here is I've developed 3 different measurable goals. They demonstrate 2 things. First of all, the outcome, you'll see the component outcome, use this one here, the component outcome is in this case writing waste discharge requirements for all discharging ranches, and then the component time frame. So each of those demonstrates that. But this also illustrates more and less direct measures of water quality. Goal 1 here directly measures water quality as its outcome. Goal 2 measures more behavioral changes of the ranchers. They're implementing BMPs, and that's what we're measuring. Goal 3 actually measures the agency that's implementing it. It measures the number of waste discharge requirements we write towards achieving change in water quality. Now, for us in this process, this is a much more powerful goal than this. And we want to try to focus our efforts towards developing goals of that quality.
John, is the word ranch synonymous with farm?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's probably some jargon that has slipped in from the enrollment process under the ag waiver. Okay, and I left this in. There was some debate about leaving this in or taking this out. What I wanted to emphasize from this is that output associated with this type of goal does not equal outcome, the desired outcome or the vision of water quality change necessarily. It's not to say that we shouldn't write waste discharge requirements, but rather we should consider whether the actions we are selecting will yield outcomes that are consistent with our vision and will give us the ability to directly and quantitatively measure our progress towards that vision. So as I mentioned in workshop 3, we initiated development of measurable goals. But what we learned in the process is it takes more time. This is more of a craftsmanship activity here. And what we will likely do now is go back and form focus groups or technical expert groups to address each of the issue statements and come back and work on them in that fashion.
So where does monitoring fit into this little snippet of this issue statement? You know, monitoring and then some kind of a feedback where, okay, let's say you achieve goal 2, you implement BMPs, but you find that on some ranches or farms the BMPs are not effective at reducing impairment. I mean, at some point do you then implement another interim goal?
Now you're building a segue to Karen's presentation, I think.
Okay. Yeah, Jeff, we will have, when we develop measurable goals from these issue statements, what we want to do is have be as close to goal one as possible rather than come up with goal three. You know, agencies spend most of their time, or can spend most of their time, in the goal three category, where we're talking about how many permits we write, how many orders, things like that, instead of doing actual physical measurements in the real world. So part of developing these goals is to measure our progress, and measuring our progress means we're going to be using CCAMP to do that, and that's physical measurements in the field. So it's a bigger process than just setting the goal. We also have to figure out a mechanism for measuring whether we are achieving that goal or not.
Okay.
That's part of the process.
Jeff, I don't want to casually sidestep your question either. These are long-range goals.
Right.
And then we will also come back as part of a later portion of this process and develop those interim goals that I talked about. Long-range being the horizon, what I think are what you're describing fit into the category of the shorter time-range goals. And we'll be developing those as part of the later part of this process.
Good.
All right, so partly because of time and partly because we're there, to conclude and wrap is we do have some remaining next steps, and as I said, the most obvious segue following the methodology that we're following is to start developing the measurable goals, followed by the vision statement, followed by more interactions with board members related to the vision statement. So this is just our, at this point, this is when we think we would next most directly engage you. Oops, sorry. Next one, yeah. But in the broader picture and as an ongoing, continuing set of activities, this is what we're looking at. So we have not designed at all or initiated the subsequent phases of this methodology. We haven't talked about how we're going to work on aligning the organization and ultimately how we're going to implement and measure, which is some of the specifics of what you were just raising, Jeff, related to how monitoring fits in, because we want to wait till we've really completed that vision statement and then build everything around that. However, as part of everything else we do now, we recognize that we absolutely need to involve you. We need to involve other stakeholders, and we need to keep you informed and keep ourselves on track at how we're doing, status, and kind of effort we're putting into it and what we're getting for the time and when we think we might actually be able to do something with this and have our vision and move forward. So that concludes my comments. And open it up for discussion for a few minutes, and then we have Karen making a presentation that should relate directly to what we were just talking about.
If I could just add something, and maybe it's going to be covered later, but this is just a thought I had coming into this, was that, and it really was prompted by something Michael said and Roger a few months ago to me, and that was that there's many activities that we do, you know, within the board itself, whether it's 401 certification or writing permits or doing enforcement or doing planning. And each of these, to me, are opportunities for us to be implementing whatever you're going to come up with. And that no matter who the staff person is and no matter what they're dealing with, this is the collaborative approach I think you were getting at. But it ties into this, that each of these activities to greater or lesser degrees involve an opportunity to implement this vision.
Right.
So I just, you know, hope that as you go through this process, you will start, you know, maybe checking things off. Gee, you know, when we do 401s, we could be doing this also at the same point in time.
Yeah. That's actually phase two in the big picture. We got phase one, phase two, phase three. We're in phase one right now. Phase two is aligning the organization to achieve the goals. And that means we look at every single thing that we do, every task that we do, and we ask ourselves, is this helping us achieve these goals? So it will be every task that is done within every program.
Good. The other thing would be whether we need to work cooperatively with other regions to implement maybe some of the tougher things. Like, you know, if you guys, I mean, there's many statements in here involving urbanization and population growth. Well, these are heavy items, and we know there's going to be a lot of growth in the next few decades. And so ideally, we're going to need to change land use practices so that at least we don't continue to degrade water quality. So, you know, we may gain impetus by involving the other regions somehow.
I agree. An example of that is the state's general stormwater permit, which will be revised in 3 years, Jennifer. And when that's revised, we'll play a major role in the language that is in that permit, along with other regions. And we'll want to see that language reflect the goals that we come up with.
Good. Okay.
Okay. Karen, are you ready? No?
Unbelievable. They went to sleep and shut everything
down. So you're rebooting?
Yes.
Okay.
Rebooted well in advance.
Michael? Can I make a comment?
Sure.
I wouldn't want the board members to think this is an easy process. This sort of miniature or mini process we did today went very smooth. But it took a lot of staff time to come up with those five statements. And if you look at the attachment one, all those bulleted items are the things that we envision being included in the issue statement. And most of the things that you were concerned with are included in those bulleted items. And that's going to be used as we go on through the steps to make sure they're interpreted fully.
I think they're great. I like going down through them. Some of them are a little repetitive or overlap with, you know, central themes. And it's great because you can pull out items from each of these and find what the action item is, you know, what can we do with it, whether it's a land use issue or something else, or lack of scientific data.
Right. So there was a lot of overlap in the issue statements, and that's why the steering committee got together and distilled all of the issue statements or all of the statements into these four or five final issue statements. That was actually the process they went through, distilling them down, because there was so much overlap.
Is there anything that has taken place like this either at the state board level? And I know that they have a strategic plan, but I haven't looked at that.
Right.
The state board went through a
similar process with the strategic plan. They went around and talked to all of the regions, spent a lot of time in Sacramento with the state board. And I think there were two sessions at each regional board where they got input from staff and then took that back to Sacramento with them. This is a consulting group that I'm talking about. I don't remember the name of it. Took that information back to Sacramento and develop the strategic plan, which has goals, objectives, and measures. So it's a similar process, but the strategic plan is a very high-level statewide plan, and what we're doing would be specific to Region 3, to the Central Coast.
Does any of this dovetail into any of the strategic plan
items? I think it does. It might, if you had... If you ask different people, you'll get a different answer. I think it dovetails in because the strategic plan is general. So whatever we come up with, I think it would be very difficult for us to come up with something, measurable goals, that would not be in line with the strategic plan because the strategic plan is more vague and statewide.
Can I just add something, Mike? At one point, actually, the steering committee took a lot of the brainstorm statements and tried to align them and put them, group them per the existing goals. I think there's five or six goals in the strategic plan. So they do align really well. They're just broader. The other thing I was going to comment on is, you know, I reviewed a bit and tracked the strategic planning process that the consultants used for that process. And that was a great example of a process that was, the planning part of it was effective and professional, and the plan that came out of it was as well, but it failed on implementation because the intent was for it to be implemented by all of us and for each of us to have on our, you know, cube walls an awareness of how the work we were doing every day actually rolled up into the strategic projects, could be tracked if, you know, our performance of, you know, work plan commitments, program commitments were met at the end of the year, how that rolled up and related to a particular goal and whatnot, but that didn't continue to be implemented fully and effectively all the way through at all levels of the organization. So there's definitely some great things to learn from that process as far as what went right, and there's also some great things to learn as far as what went wrong or didn't continue. So,
well, have we left anything out in these five issues that exist in the strategic plan?
I doubt it. I'd have to look back at the notes. Where's Linda? Is Linda still in the room?
Yeah, but I don't have.
Yeah. No, but did you remember from when we organized it that way?
If our issue statements were the issue statements in the strategic plan,
yes,
we didn't do that comparison.
Well, are we supposed to be implementing the strategic plan? And if we are, at least we should have our bases covered so that, you know, we're not totally going off.
Yeah,
you know.
I agree. Martin.
Another part to that answer is the strategic plan, as Mike was saying, is very general because it's a statewide document. One of the cornerstone technical parts of it from a water quality standpoint is the focus on a watershed approach. And one of the ways I've looked at this is that with the watershed approach, I think we're really focusing on trying to coordinate existing programs within watersheds. And so the right hand knows what the left hand is doing, and we look at the watershed as a whole rather than just by programs. But I think one of the different ways of looking at this effort is, first of all, it's regional, so it's more customized for our region, but then also in being more proactive in terms of what should the watershed look like in the future, what should the water body within the watershed look like, and how should that watershed affect the marine environment to which it discharges. So it's, I think the idea in part is to be more proactive, visualize what we want the watersheds to look like, not just coordinate our programs within the watersheds. And then there are other parts of the strategic plan that are more business process oriented, efficiency oriented, talks about making improvements in information technology and the way that we just conduct our day-to-day business, which is not at all contrary to what we're talking about here. That's just a kind of a different slant, I think. And, of course, the State Board has the other half of their responsibilities. And in addition to water quality, there's the Water Rights Division, which that's not completely divorced from what we've been talking about here, because certainly if there isn't enough water in our creeks, we don't have much habitat. And you'll see that kind of reflected in here, and we should have a better syncing between the water rights part of the State Board's activities and the water quality issues. But I don't see any conflicts. It's something that we should keep our eye on as we go forward through this process and make sure that we're not doing something that is contrary to the strategic plan. I just don't see that happening, frankly.
Good. I just wanted to make sure that we were not leaving anything out, and if we do implement these other components in this process, that's what we should be doing.
Sorrel, you had a comment?
I just wanted to add that it was interesting, the one thing that fairly significant thing that I think is in the strategic plan that's not reflected here in our comments is the exact item that Ms. Hunter brought up, was public education and accessibility of information.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Bruce, do you know where we are at? Did you don't?
We're going to talk about monitoring now.
Your mic's not on. Okay.
Does that work?
Yep.
Good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was being very smug because I didn't have PowerPoint, and then the LAN connection went down, and I lost my entirely web-based connection. But I do want to make the point that this presentation is being done on our website. We're not having pictures about what the website could be, but it's what it is. So I think that's a good thing to remember. And if you're looking at data in one location, you think, boy, I'd like to know that about another location, you can go there yourself and find it from our website. So, so we've been talking about trying to be an organization that achieves its goals by implementing a vision. And obviously, if we want to implement measurable goals, then we need to figure out certainly practical and cost-effective ways to do the measuring. And that is where monitoring comes in, of course. And staff recognize this. In fact, there's an issue pretty much devoted to the need to measure tangible results and make well-informed decisions, and that need is increasing faster than existing surface water and regional groundwater monitoring and assessment capabilities. And, of course, you know, monitoring is expensive and can be resource intensive. So I'm going to talk today a little bit about our program, not so much about our monitoring per se, but about some of the ways that we have made our data as useful and available as we can, and then talk a little bit about where we hope to go, and in part in order to support this effort we've been talking about today. John alluded to direct and indirect measures, and obviously monitoring data is one form of a direct measurement of improvement in water quality. But even if we choose to use indirect measures, I think if we don't think carefully about how we're going to manage that information from the start, we may not get there 20 years from now, because institutions tend to have short memories. So I think really focusing on information management and how to get where we want to go is going to be really important in terms of making this successful. There is a huge data need out there, but I'm not sure that always what we need to do is run out and do more monitoring. Sometimes what I think we need to do is better information management and make sure that the data we do have is in a place we can get it and is in a format that people can understand. And so I think that has really been, from our program standpoint, our model, because we started with virtually no resources. So we said, okay, let's just see if we can make what we have as useful as possible. But I have a feeling that's where we're going to continue to need to be, which is making sure that the information that's out there is used, is accessible, is pulled together in one place so staff can find it. And I'm going to talk about that today, too. So we are in progress with a fairly significant website remodel. And I'd like to point to Dave Paradis here, who has done all of our software development for the website. And Mary, who is not here, has done all the content collection out in the field. Oh, there she is. Yay. Two-thirds of my team. I'm the other one. that's not true. We have our field crew, too. But we're not a large group. And some of this stuff can be pretty time intensive. So I want to talk briefly about the upgrades to the website, some more tools that we've built and that we've provided access to through links to other existing tools that are out there.
some thoughts we have on some of the potential new initiatives that might be coming out of this process, how we can use information management effectively. And then, again, just to reiterate that because we're sort of a resource-limited program, and it's not just money, I would say in our case it's probably more staff than money, we are going to need to be thinking about that unless we want to drastically change what we are doing, which I would rather not see. So monitoring is expensive, and there's lots of ways to track trends without necessarily needing to go out and take more samples. So I think we need to be creative about how we address it and be thinking about how possibly to garner some new resources. I think 2 years ago at the offsite, I did a tour of the website, but it's changed quite a lot. Oh, what is that? I hate it when it helps. Since then, it's a lot prettier, I think, and I hope a lot more useful. And Dave's pirate a lot of internet map servers from other sources to help us get better access to maps that staff can use. So just as an example, this is our region. If we were to go look at, wanted to look at Carmel River more specifically, what this allows you to do is drill in a fairly high level of detail to a map area. These are little planning watersheds. And once you get to the area you're interested in, we provided several different kinds of images from other map services that are out there. This is aerial and satellite imagery. And this is like similar to a USGS topo map. These are at a scale that are not particularly useful, but I've already drilled into more detail if I can find them. That's not it. I have to flip through all these. There we go. That's that image at the 8-power zoom, which is on the front screen. So this is the Carmel River mouth. And you can see here's the riparian corridor. Here's a treatment plant in the riparian corridor. You can see how the corridor changes right here around the road. There's been some activity, and the ag fields are kind of moving in on it a bit. As you go upstream, you can just see how what its probable former line might have looked like, maybe not. When you get up into the golf course here, you can hardly see it, but it runs right through here. And where is that development we like? There it is. That's the river right there. So you can see how urban development's encroaching on this system. And I think these images are going to be pretty useful for staff working at a site level. This is the other map. You can see how we get nice detail on where the plant is. And it actually does a pretty good job of mapping the riparian corridor. There's that same feature you saw in the photographic image. So I think that this mapping tool is going to help a lot, and we're hoping at some point to get our sites actually on top of that, but that's going to take some additional work. But the zoom I was using was right here up on the front of the screen. I think you've seen other aspects of this website. This is the looking at any watershed you're interested in by analyte. Carmel is particularly clean, so it's a little less interesting than some. Maybe I'll go back and look at one that's less so. Let's see. We'll pick Salinas. And if I wanted to go look at nitrate, which is an easy parameter to look at because we have a water quality standard and so forth, which is 10 is for drinking water. For most of these parameters, we have a little bit of information on the parameters so you know more about it, why it's a problem, a map of the watershed. This is the percent exceedance of the standard. So if, for example, 25% of our samples or more exceeded the drinking water standard, these sites are red. So you can see we've got quite a bit of red down in the lower end of the Salinas. And then these maps are in higher level of detail here.
No data means you have a site, but you've
got right.
data.
These are all generated on the fly. And we have, so For example, we might do a special study looking at mercury or something in the upper watershed where we're doing something different. So we have sites in our database and on all our maps, but they may not be part of our regular nitrate sampling program. So no data may mean for the Muscle Watch program, you could find data at that site. They wouldn't be in there if there's no data at all for them, I hope. You never know. So if we were to pick a site, for example, let's look at 309 Old. That's the old Salinas River. It's down at the bottom of Tembladero Slough. This is just averages in range by water body. And then here it is by the actual site name. So you can find 309 Old here and see there it is in the ranking. Oh, hi, Amanda. And coming down farther. This table basically summarizes the data, and there's a little bit on the criteria we're using. And that's been one of the most challenging things about providing data, is that there aren't that many criteria for the things we measure, and they often are specific to a single site or a single beneficial use or saltwater only. And so when you're trying to build a website that generalizes, then it's very complicated as to how you use these standards. And we actually have got this. It's getting there, but it's getting to a point where it's actually pulling in site-specific or water body-specific standards too. So it uses whatever is most appropriate to screen on. It goes down to the water body-specific level. But in this case, it's using nitrate. And let's go down and look at, just so I can take you all the way through this process, Old Salinas River. You can see the maximum was 42, with limits 10. The minimum was 1, lots of 1.19. Lots of times in the winter, for example, you might have a lot of dilution, see much lower values. This is an average geomean and so forth. This is the sample count. We had 44 samples at that site. That's how many exceeded the standard. There's a standard. And then you get a time series. So this is the actual, let's see, we have data starting in 1999 at this site. This is a pretty robust time series because this is one of our coastal confluence monitoring sites. See, it's highly variable, though, but it's almost always over the drinking water standard here. Okay, so that is sort of the basics as to how the watershed navigator works by analytes, but you can also go in and look at more detail at a site level or at a water body level. So again, if I wanted to look at Old Salinas River, this gives you actually photographs of the site. We sample every time we go out. Mary takes a photograph. I'm not sure why that's not coming up, but things are slow today. But we have a lot of extended information from other websites that basically Dave is taking the latitude, longitude from our site and linking into other sites so that when you go there, you go to the correct geographic area in their website. You shouldn't have to fool around trying to figure out where you need to go. So, for example, in this case, if you wanted to go look at groundwater data in this area, this will take you straight to the GeoTracker program, which the other half of our office uses. Or if you wanted to look and see if there's any USGS flow gauges in the area, it takes you straight into these water bodies, and you can, some of this is actually real-time data where you can see what's going on right now in terms of flow. This is some May 31st at, where am I?
San Antonio.
So there's a number of gauges on the Salinas system, so it's showing you those. So there's a lot of resources in here, and in this case, what this is also showing you is everything we measure at that site. It's summarizing everything we measure, you know, for the same kinds of range, mean, median, and so forth. And it's also flagging things based on whether it appears as though we have a significant problem. It's actually using the same formulas that are in the 303D listing criteria, which is uses a binomial distribution to determine if there's sufficient evidence of a problem. I think it's 10% exceedance with a certain range of variability. So these red sites are ones that appear to have a problem. One of the challenges with our data, in some cases, is that some of the objectives are maybe not right on. For example, we see a lot of pH violations throughout our region, but we know that we have relatively high pH coming out of some of our, you know, upper watersheds that actually violate some of our standards. 8.3 is the upper standard, and we see that all the time in ambient water quality. So a lot of things that are flagged get flagged for reasons like that, that the objective may be off, maybe it need to be amended. Okay, I'm going to quit with this. Let's see what else. Oh, well, you can get access to the impaired waters here also. All right, I'm going to go on to sort of our new initiatives section. Hold on. I'm going to do it, though. It's the easy way. Okay. I'm going to start talking about with agricultural waiver monitoring. And actually, tomorrow we're going to have a workshop in this room with the monitoring subcommittee of the ag effort to talk about some of the data management things I'm going to be showing you here today. So it's very convenient. And what Dave here has done is swiped the Central Coast Water Quality Preservation Inc.'s homepage motif. So if you go to their website, which is right here, you'll see it looks very much, I'm a little worried about this connection, it's slow today. It looks a lot like it. That's because he's basically stolen it and created something that will look a lot like their website to demo this for them. And if they want to use this, what we're basically saying is this is one way we can proceed with storing and viewing data, and we can put this on their website for their use. So we've had an incredible amount of information come into the office recently, including ranches owned by Roger Briggs and Michael Thomas, I see. And basically, they need to, they're reporting what kinds of practices they're implementing. And in this case, these are all erosion control practices, and you can see they can say whether the practice is in place, whether they're planning to do it. So all this data has come into the office, and it's all been put into the system. And let me go back here. What the Ag Waiver staff, Mark Angelo and Dave, worked together to start putting that into some map format so we can actually start tracking where practices are being implemented. And so this basically, this is that data. This is the enrollment data. And this shows you, for example, where we have erosion control strategies in place and where they are planned. And you can see it's different. It's kind of interesting because there are more in place than are planned, which means most people feel that they're doing what they can do to keep their soil on their land. Now, it may not solve the problem necessarily, which is why it's also important to track water quality, because people may be implementing BMPs. You know, nobody wants their soil to erode, but it may or may not be solving the problem in the water column. So I can zoom in and look at this in greater detail if you want. Let's see. It looks something like that. And they're reporting at a township section range level, so it's by square mile. So one thing to notice is we've got pretty good coverage. What this means is that for everyone that's dark green here, somebody submitted information to us. So we have pretty decent coverage for the ag areas of our region. Okay. The way we set the data, electronic data uptake from them is so that it can feed directly into our website format, so that we can make a similar website to the one that we use. And what we are probably going to offer them is if they want to have something that's sort of a password protected type website where they can go in and look in detail at their own data. So this basically is set up to work exactly the same way ours is, so I don't need to show it to you. but it would live on their own website. And basically, we're including tools for them in order to transmit the files to us, for example. This is a little file uploader utility that will ship it directly to our office and allows you to send very large files without any problem. So just trying to build some utilities that will help them make the whole process seamless, make the data move easily, and get it up and running and viewable as quickly as possible. Dave has also been working with Howard on timber harvest. And Howard sat down with him and said, you know, I really need a website. And so Dave made him one, and here it is. And it's even clickable, see?
True to his design.
This is the original Howard website. But in fact, this one is a bit more in progress than the ag site. But the idea here is the same, where you can zoom in on these areas and get more detail in terms of the photographs, go into watersheds, look at it once we have the data in here, the turbidity data and temperature data. This list will be shorter than it is, and it will probably be primarily these two parameters.
Make sure you take the information from the Santa Cruz County map with the, you know, the barriers. That should go into that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Right. Also on this, is just some information for people applying in terms of the eligibility criteria. You can go in and look at the information here and also download the forms. So I think the point I'm trying to make here is that in terms of moving towards tracking of practices, I think we've made a lot of progress already. And in terms of, you know, having that mesh with our water quality monitoring, I think that's where we're trying to go with this right now. And you notice it says urban stormwater monitoring here, but it's not lit up yet. That's because I think that there's a real possibility we could use a similar type of framework, and I've already been talking to Jennifer about this, to track some of the practice implementation for stormwater programs. So the practice tracking software was developed by Tetra Tech.
Karen, how are you going to use the ag waiver data, monitoring data? Is that going to roll right into the CCAMP?
It will, yeah.
Data, mm-hmm. Or is it going to be kept as a separate database?
It'll be a separate database for them.
Right.
We'll have it on our website with our data, though.
Yeah.
But we haven't decided yet what level of... Right now, it's we've kept certain aspects of our website a little bit... for example, if you want to know what project something was collected through, like was it Muscle Watch, was it CCAMP, it's right now that's not apparent. It's not transparent. There's a way we could make it transparent, and that may be the next step for us, so that you can actually label where the data item came from. And I don't think it would be hard. We already know how we'd want to do that, but that would probably be the way we'd handle it. It's so when you get into the time series, it would actually give you a table underneath that says where the data items come from.
How many of the ag monitoring stations correspond with our CCAMP stations?
It started out to be quite a few, but as they started dealing with some of the just various issues that they wanted to address in terms of access or what have you, they adjusted the number. Most of them are near. Some of them are... not quite the same locations. Most, I'd say about half of them right now. Do you know, Mary? About half. And we intend to continue collecting our own conventional data at those sites, but we're going to rely on them to do the toxicity and benthic sampling because it's quite expensive, and so there's a nice... benefit to our program to not have to do that at those sites. But we'll continue with the other, partly in part to just do a quality check. Would you let me do Shorter version? Are you worried about time?
Well, shorter being what?
Well, I was going to talk about some of these little indexes, tools we've developed. Would you like to do that anyway?
Yeah, you can touch on them briefly.
Okay, we'll be brief. Just in terms of trying to, you know, you saw that sort of overwhelming list of parameters, and unless you know what to look for, it's kind of hard to use. So we've been trying to figure out how to make it more useful to people, and the public in particular, because they don't know, well, which analyte do I go look at to know something. And it's, so it's almost being buried in detail, we've decided, in terms of utility, unless you really are interested in a specific thing. So one thing we've been trying to do is look sort of at some indexes that pull information together. This one is called the Biostimulatory Risk Index. We're sort of piloting. Basically, it pulls a number of measures together, both that are causes of biostimulation, which would be nutrients, and also effects, which would be things like low dissolved oxygen or highly variable pH, and puts them all into a single index number. And this is just a graphic representation of, this is a high-quality site. Limekiln Creek is in Big Sur. And you can see its score for each of these parameters is relatively close to zero in the target here. And it actually scores as our best quality site in the region in terms of these various parameters. These are all weighted, and we've gone through quite a staffing effort to look at how it performs. And it's sort of still in progress. But this is an example of one of our worst quality sites. This is down in the Carpinteria area. It drains into Carpinteria Marsh. You can see it ranked in 85th percentile. And it allows you to get a sense of what the parameters were that were causing the most problem. In this case, this is dissolved oxygen and this is chemistry. And when you look at the region for the biostimulatory risk scores, I think we've seen this pattern before with other parameters, but there's the lower ends of the major watersheds, Salinas, Pajaro, and then up Yagas Creek, Santa Maria, and there's a number of small creeks down in Santa Barbara. The database also scans, I think I mentioned this already, actually I don't need to say this again, but it does scan on water quality objectives. And we've used this tool, in fact, we sent the output from this tool to State Board when they were doing the 303D listing process to help them. I mean, it's not a replacement for looking at the data and determining if it is suitable for listing, but it helps handle an enormous amount of information and decide whether it appears that beneficial uses aren't being supported. So in this case, we basically are looking at information down here against a standard, and then we've decided if this standard is usually associated with a beneficial use. So if it's a tissue residual, it might be for support of aquatic life or human health, for example. Okay. The National Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Program is linked to our program directly through their Sanctuary Integrated Monitoring Network, Simon. But they recently have hired a person that's going to be working on data management issues up and down the entire coast, all of the California sanctuaries. And that person is really interested in trying to tie into the same sort of data navigation that we're using here to address their data management needs up and down the coast, because they feel like they do not have a good grasp on water quality within the sanctuaries and that there's no single place they can go. So we've been in a dialogue with them about this, and once again, Dave has stolen their motif and created this is just a shell, really, but we'll see where that goes, but it could be an interesting way to improve public outreach, like Monica was suggesting. Sea otters. we're also working on another type of index that would be similar to the biostimulatory risk tool that would be more generalized as a report card. that would look at multiple measures of water quality and come up with a sort of a single score to develop a report card for the entire region. Because, again, it's this problem of pulling a whole bunch of pieces of information together to create information that you can give to the public. But you need to be careful with it. So that's in the future, I'd say. We're just starting to work on that. So there's a lot going on, but I think we're going to need to continue to put a lot of thinking into how to measure our success in terms of tracking the measurable goals. I'm assuming that we're going to be working with staff in the office to do that, sort of in a similar kind of process as Lisa and the company has started here. I think it will require a lot of thought, especially as we move into other types of indicators besides, you know, water quality trend monitoring. There are a lot of tools that are out there. I think I mentioned we've been looking at trying to tie into as many as possible. There's a large effort going on in the state looking at a wetland assessment method, and that's the California Rapid Assessment Method, CRAM. And we actually, I think Mary's been demoing their method out in the field or working with them to see how that works in association with our existing monitoring. And that is basically tying satellite imagery together with ground truthing to map wetlands more effectively. So that's a program I think that would make a lot of sense potentially to look at as a tracking tool if that's where we end up going with our measurable goals. And there's also some really interesting information that's out there related to just tracking land use changes. For example, the NOAA Coastal Change Analysis Program is a program that uses satellite imagery along the entire coastline of the United States once every 5 years. And they develop some great land cover change information. So this is a sample right off their website. This is 1990. You can see the dark green, of course, is the forests, and the urban areas are white, and grasslands, the pink. In 1995, you see a lot more grassland, more of this is low-intensity development. And then they actually calculate the difference between these two images. So that's kind of an interesting representation of change, where you can see where you're seeing changes in habitat types and so forth. And we have this data now downloaded for our entire region for 1995 and 2000. And they're enormous data sets. And it's, you know, example of where a few more bodies working with this data, we could really pull some interesting information out of it, I think. So. Broken fish. finally, Department of Forestry, doing a lot of their fire planning, they have some really great information in GIS format as well for the entire state. And this is off of their website. And this is basically looking at historical and projected development. The colors that range from yellow to dark red are past development. So yellow is 1939 or earlier, and the dark red is 1990 to 2000. So you can see pretty much where, for example, Old Monterey grew out and became larger Monterey. Oops, that's not Monterey. Wherever I'm, Santa Cruz. Yeah. This green palette is projected development, looking at, projected land uses in the future. The lightest green is for the next 10 years, and the darkest green is 2031 to 40. So it's kind of interesting to see. It's actually not a huge amount of spatial area, but it's probably a lot of it high intensity. You can see there's Fresno. That's kind of interesting. Another thing that's interesting to notice is some areas, isn't there a new city predicted or something out in the east part of the county? I was going to point out Hollister and Gilroy. Here's Hollister. A lot of recent development. And then...
where's the sewer plant?
I don't know. This is just other resources they have. This is just looking at types of ownership, whether it's private, public, developable, not developable. So this just gives you information about where possible development could occur and so forth. Okay. So that's a lot of things to think about in terms of tools and opportunities and so forth. I think that's all I need to say, but I think, you know, it should be fun.
Two-part question. How many participants currently contribute data to CCAMP, and then is there an upper limit on how big it can get?
Right now, this website is our data, although we've included other partner organizations such as State Muscle Watch Program, Toxic Substances Monitoring Program. The reasons are complicated. It has mainly to do with levels of data quality. Originally, we were going to put everything into one pile. And then we started to decide that if we really couldn't vouch for the data, we want our website to be this one source. But what we have done is developed other sort of parallel websites. So, for example, the Citizens Monitoring Program for the sanctuary uses the same software to create their own website. So, and we have their data in our format. And if we ever want to make a second website that rolls everything together, we can do that. At this point, it just is our data.
No theoretical maximum. It's just how much fits on the disk. Too much data, buy another disk.
Couple of questions, Karen. How are you doing funding-wise?
We got back $100,000 this year. We'd had a 33% cut last year, and they reinstated it in part through some efforts of our friends, our political friends in Sacramento. Yeah. How'd that work again?
The statewide budget was set at $5.5 million for a surface water ambient monitoring program. The recent budget language from the legislature will augment that with perhaps $4.5 million per year. We're optimistic that will make it through the governor's office.
The public advisory group that's been working on TMDL and monitoring issues has been really lobbying heavily on behalf of monitoring.
So are we going to potentially get more money in the next budget? Amazing. And what about...
But there's also a big dialogue going on about regional boards not doing a good enough job with the money and that they should take it all up to the state board and do statewide monitoring. So there's some risk there. And, if you look at the programs across the state, they're different, obviously, and people are doing different things with their money. And some are doing better than others. And what we're trying to do is take a piece of the money and do a statewide program on the regions would still be able to continue their own work because regions have different priorities than the state. And the state is interested in very big picture questions like what percent of our waters are impaired by coliform, for example. And that's a hard question for us to then take the answer of and apply it in a practical way.
Do you have on your radar incorporating high quality water monitoring, something I picked out of one of the issues in here, to new chemicals, things of this nature? I mean, are you anticipating expanding?
It's all been budget limited.
Right.
For example, we do monitor higher quality waters as you move up some of the larger watersheds, but for example, where most of it's sort of a tributary. Lower end tributary monitoring entering. So ideally, if we had more sites, we'd like to get higher in the major tributaries and see some of those more pristine areas. But That definitely is resource limited, the number of sites we can cover. And then in terms of the parameters that we cover, we have not, for example, gotten into water column sampling for priority organics or something. You know, we don't do that type of sampling because of the cost and also because of the payoff. You know, we would have a lot of non-detects. And when we do have a lot of problems we want to measure, so we've sort of been strategic about deciding what things we're going to measure. I think it would be beneficial to do some, you know, with some of the newer methods, looking at some of the more urbanized regions that are starting some monitoring efforts for those kinds of things, seeing how they do, and then maybe doing some localized efforts to see what we see in high-risk areas before we do something widespread. Yeah.
We are working with other programs and other scientific groups to do to address issues like that. For example, we're doing some work with the folks involved with both sea otters and with elephant seals. But the elephant seal project is one where we're looking at strains of coliform bacteria that are resistant to certain biocides and pharmaceuticals. If these coliform bacteria have developed that resistance, then we know that coming off the land or out of the treatment plant is reaching the marine mammals. And that paper is in press now, so there'll be some results you may find interesting in that area.
That actually was a really interesting study. It looks like we're seeing a relationship between areas with high freshwater influence and resistance. So. But that's been done at a larger scale than our region.
Really should wrap it up here. Yep. We're kind of behind schedule. Should have an opportunity for public comment if there is any request to have comment on this whole item. I don't have any cards up here. Okay. So we will, as Lisa and John were talking about earlier, we'll be bringing back our work products to you and have continued discussion with you, and I know Les came in late, and Bruce came in a little bit late, so I'll have to do some catching up with you as well as the board members who weren't here with us today, but we'll do that. So do we need to announce a possible adjournment closed session?
We're going to discuss whether to initiate litigation.
Thank you very much.
Am I plugged in?
We probably won't have time to do that.
Never mind.
Okay, so if it's all right with you, Mr. Chairman, we will adjourn to the upstairs veranda area up there.
Good.
And get something to eat before we head out with Dan and company on our field trip. Thanks, everyone.